All right, we don't have a quorum yet, so we're going to go ahead and get started, and then we'll move the bills appropriately and take action on them when we do have a quorum. First bill up, we're going to entertain at this moment is House File 3841, Representative Hosh. Welcome. House File 3481, and we're going to lay the bill over when we do make the motion to bring it before us for possible inclusion. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 3841 simply clarifies how the DNR can identify what a not-for-profit organization is. As you may know, last year the legislature gave authorization to be able to administer a fee for a fishing contest permit. It was also the intention of the legislature that nonprofits could have that fee waived. However, without strict clarification within the legislation, the DNR did choose through an opinion of the Attorney General to identify a nonprofit as a 501c3 who is registered through their Attorney General. As you may know, in many of our rural areas, we have sportsman's clubs that have no employees, that are small in nature, have local fishing contests, and are also classified as a nonprofit, but not through the Attorney General's office, but through the Secretary of State's office. This came about locally with me with the Painesville Sportsman's Club, who was going to have a Northern Pike fishing contest, could not have that application or that permit be waived, even though they've been a nonprofit since 1959. So this bill just simply clarifies that you can have the fee waived if you're a nonprofit registered through the Secretary of State.
And we have a quorum now, so Chair will bring before us House File 3841 for possible inclusion. Mr. Meyer, you in here? Bob Meyer?
I see Mr. Boggan.
He left. Mr. Boggan. Or Ron Fire, I guess. I see you in here.
They're all pointing at each other.
They're all going different directions. Welcome, Mr. Pryor. The question the Chair has of you is, if we broaden the beyond the 501c3 to determine the organization's waiver, and we broadened it to 501c4s and 6s, which are generally the other types of organizations in your communities, how many people would we have left that would be paying for a license?
Mr. Chairman, members, Ron Player with DNR Fish and Wildlife. Mr. Chairman, we currently permit about 600 permits a year for applications, and right now about 25% of those are applying for the 501c. Our estimate would be another 25% would probably qualify under the nonprofit, so we'd probably we're not sure exactly how many would do that, but it would probably end up with about half of the 600 that we currently permit would be exempt.
So, Mr. Fire, make sure I have that right, and then that would mean that 50% are not for are not nonprofits or 501c3s that are applying. Correct,
Mr. Chairman. That's our best estimate at this time.
Okay, and as I recall, in 2006, I think we redid the fees to try and recoup the cost to more appropriately recoup the cost that the department needs to issue those permits. And if we broadened this, we would then have to raise the costs on the remaining 50% to get the teeter-totter balanced again. Would that be your assumption?
Mr. Chairman, if we were going to recover the cost, that's what we would have to do, but the statute lists a cap on the cost, so that would need to be changed. Right now there's a cap, and if we estimate that we spend about $100,000 a year administering the tournament permit program. So the cap, if we were going to recover those that entire amount, then we would need to change that cap if our intent was to do that, or if your intent was to do that.
Representative Simpson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You're kind of going down the same trail I was going to go. I think it was 2007. I think it was just last year we put this in place, wasn't it? What kind of reaction did we get back from our fishing, from the rest of the community? There's a fishing people out there that are doing these tournaments. I mean, was the reaction positive, or did we get beat up for it, for putting the fees in place or whatever?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Simpson, you know, there was a mixed bag. I would say that a lot of people raised the concern with the price, how much it was. I think most tournament sponsors feel that some fee to help recover costs was reasonable, but we heard particularly from the smaller tournament sponsors that it was a high fee for them to cover.
Now, to that point, then, I guess I would think that if we do something like this and make a change, that I would certainly want to see to it that we didn't do anything that would jeopardize those smaller operations. You know, if we're going to make a change, it would definitely want to be towards the higher end facility. So, thank you.
And, Mr. Pryor, could you remind us, what do those smaller organizations pay right now for not the 501c3s that are obviously have the waiver, but the alleged for-profit smaller and the 501c4s and 6s that don't get the waiver, and they're smaller organizations? What do they pay?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, if you look at the backside of the current bill on 3841, it lists the fees, and basically the small operations would pay $120 for an open water contest, and then we scaled it based on larger and smaller tournaments and whether or not there was an off-site weigh-in or not, because those take more energy to administer if there's an off-site weigh-in.
So it would be a dollar under line 2.1 of the current, the way it's currently written, it costs $1.20 for the first 100 participants. Okay, anybody have any further questions on this? Nope. Okay, anything else you'd like to add, Representative Hosh?
Well, I appreciate the committee's time, Mr. Chair. I hope that this can be included in the omnibus bill. This is for our small neighborhood, community, nonprofit sportsman's club who, when we do have these fishing contests, bring a lot of economic activity into the rural communities. I also want to point out, too, that since this law has just recently been enacted, I still think there's a lot of organizations that have not run into this complication yet, because many of our fishing contests happen at the beginning of the year, and due to the legislature passing this at the end of last session, not a lot of people have been caught up in this. I know for the Painesville Sportsman's Club, it was an August fishing contest in which this came about. So I think my other ones, like in St. Joseph and Richmond, so on and so forth, will appreciate the committee's support come this spring.
Mr. Pryor, one more question. Can you remind the committee who has to have a fishing license to participate in one of these?
Mr. Chairman, anyone that would normally require a fishing license would require, if you're not required to have a license through other mechanisms, you're not required to have one for the tournament.
Okay, thank you. All right, Chair Wanu's motion to lay over House Bill 3841 for possible inclusion. Thank you, Representative Hosh.
Thank you.
Minutes. Representative Hanson, you moved the minutes to March 5th and March 3rd. March
yes.
3rd and 5th. Any discussion on the minutes? Being none, all in favor of the minutes say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion does prevail. Thank you. Now coming before us is Representative Olin, House File 2201. The chair will move 2201 before us. Representative Olin, go ahead with your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This bill, in its original form, would give a lifetime deer hunting license to a resident who has been a firearms safety volunteer for at least 25 years, instructor. I ran into considerable resistance from DNR on this proposal, so I have a DE1 amendment that I would like to incorporate into this bill.
Okay, the chair will move the DE1 amendment to the amendment.
Okay, basically what the DE1 amendment does is gives a license on a yearly basis to a person who has taught firearm safety instructing for at least 30 years. The other thing it also does, it's only a yearly basis license, and it's 30 years instead of 25. The reason for bringing this bill is Alan Paulson from Thief River Falls, who's actually got a certificate date that I believe is passed out to all of you that says 1966, so he's been a certified firearm safety instructor for 42 years, requested that I bring it. I have had contact with some other deer hunting firearm safety instructors. This is the only letter I actually have. And based on the fact that they're doing this as a volunteer service, so what they're hoping to gain from the state is some consideration for the fact that they've done these volunteer services for all these years. I see Bob Meyer is here, and I would guess he's got some testimony he'd like to give.
Mr. Chair, members of the record, Bob Meyer.
I did move the amendment.
We'll need to vote on the amendment, the DE-1 amendment, to get the bill in the shape that the author wants it. So any further discussion on the DE-1 amendment? Being none, all in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. The bill is amended. Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chair, members, for the record, Bob Meyer, Assistant Commissioner with the Department of Natural Resources. We have looked at the bill, and I believe this bill was in front of this body last year as well. We did have some concerns with it. Currently, firearm safety instructors are recognized through recognition programs at every level, the 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, 20. After 25 years, they receive a print. Usually that print of the year is valued at $70, $75. It's a frame print. So we do recognize firearm safety instructors right now. We have no shortage of firearm safety instructors. So it's not like we need a recruitment or a retention tool. What this would do here, we would probably stop doing that practice of prints, or look at how we're promoting and rewarding firearm safety instructors, and if they wanted a deer license, they would be able to have that option. We do have this ability currently in law right now. And just speaking as a certified firearm safety instructor myself, most people do it because of the joy they get out of working with children and teaching children how to safely handle firearms and participate in the shooting sports, not for a free deer license. So I guess, Mr. Chair, to summarize, the department doesn't see the need, nor have we heard the need, to do additional recognition for firearm safety instructors. And just on a side note, to continue your certification, all you need to do is once every 2 years, your name has to show up on a firearm safety training roster. So if a person were to go out and do such as I did last Saturday, do a range day with children at the gun club for 2 hours once every 2 years, and you did that 15 times, now it would make you eligible for one of these free licenses. So we just do have some concerns about it, and we don't really see the need for the recognition at this level.
Well, thank you. And I assume that the 30 years, by going from 25 to 30, it reduces the fiscal impact, Representative Owen.
Yeah, I'm sure, and it's also on a year-to-year basis, so it's not a lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
So it would lower the fiscal impact.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly how low, I don't know.
Mr. Meyer, I'm going to hit you with one that, having served on the Finance Committee for a while, usually comes up when we talk about free licenses. It says a person authorized to issue licenses must issue without a fee. As I recall, there's a fee. Even if the license is free, there's a fee and cost to the state to issue a license. It was about a buck a time, as I remember. Tell us about that.
Mr. Chair, members, there are fees associated with just the operation of the ELS system, which is approximately $1 per license. There are also the fees at the deputy registers or the ELS agents that they would not be exempt from, I do believe. So there would still be $1.50 per transaction if they used the credit card. With Representative Cornish's bill, there would be that credit card transaction fee should that go to pass as well. So, but one other note, Mr. Chair, we have many other safety instructors who've served many, many years. Snowmobile license certified instructors, ATV license instructors. Should this pass, maybe the snowmobile instructors will want a free trail permit each year for their duties. And then, you know, where are we going to stop? So it's just a question that I've heard from several other people looking at the bill.
But you won't see me introducing that bill, Mr. Meyer. All right. Anyone to testify for or against the bill as amended? Being none, Representative Olin, any final thoughts?
Well, I'd be curious if the Deer Hunters Association wanted to weigh in at all if they're here. I don't know if they are. I didn't notice.
I don't see Mr. Keller in here. Nope. All right, Chair Lanou's motion to layover for possible inclusion, House File 2201. Thank you very much, Representative Olin.
Thank you.
Next bill up before us, Representative Junkie, are you here? So we'll go to Representative Kudin. And members, this is a land bill. And the Chair will move House File 3709 for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Lands Bill, which is now over in the Finance Committee. Representative Kudin, thank you very much. First question of you before you present the bill. The DNR has approved this bill.
Mr. Chairman, that is my understanding that Ms. Lewis, from the Assistant Director from Division Lands and Minerals at the DNR.
All right, very good. Go ahead with the bill, House File 3709.
Okay, Mr. Chairman and committee members, I do have an amendment to the A08-1288 amendment.
Okay, the Chair will move the 1288 amendment to get the bill in the shape the author wants. Discussion? There being none, in favor of the 1288 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. House File 3709 as amended. Representative Kudin.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. And this is a land transfer to the county of Chippewa. They're going to use the land to develop a park. I have with me today Mr. Scott Williams from the Land Use and Zoning Office in Chippewa County, and also Jim Dalvang, Chippewa County Commissioner, and they'll explain the project rules for a few minutes here.
Welcome. If you state your name for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Jim Dalvang, Chippewa County Commissioner.
I just want to caution you, don't talk too much because the DNR has already approved this. You might talk them out of it.
I just want to state that after the 97 flood by Chippewa County purchased the property, and it's approximately 30 acres, and we are in the process of developing the park, and there's these three parcels that are owned by the state that we need transferred, and the one largest one borders the river, so that's why we're here.
Okay.
I don't have anything to add. You know, I'll leave it there.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Anybody on the committee have any questions about House File 3709 as amended? Ms. Lewis, do you thumbs up or thumbs down on this one? Thumbs up, she indicates that we're good to go on this. Ms. Lewis indicates that. Further discussion on the bill as amended. All right. Chair will renew his motion for House File 3709 for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Lands Bill. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails, and we are on our way to possible inclusion. Thank you very much. I know it was a long way to come down here for just a couple of minutes, but...
We thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Good that we didn't have any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, you're welcome. I don't see Jackie in here. Okay. Representative Fritz. Chair will move House File 3788 for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Lands Bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I have before me the House File 3788, and I thank you for hearing it today. This is a parcel of land that is owned by the Minnesota Correctional Facility in Faribault State Property. We've been in many meetings for the past, I believe, 4 or 5 years to look for land to site our county jail. And we have found the land at the correctional facility. And this has been agreed upon by both the Commissioner Fabian, and the our county commissioners, our sheriff, and all of those interested parties, our county administrator, Gary Wires, and I'm carrying this piece of legislation to your committee today to have it included. And I need a vehicle. And that's why I'm here. Help me out, please.
Okay, thank you very much. Any questions of Representative Fritz, members? Ms. Lewis? Ms. Lewis, can you give us the rundown on this one? There's this is admin land, or?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Kathy Lewis, Lands and Minerals, DNR. This is a piece of property that is not DNR managed, nor is it tax forfeited. So we were checking in with the Commission of Administration, because they're the ones who dispose of state land to some agencies, and I hadn't heard back from them. So the DNR itself had no problems with it, but I hadn't heard back from that other agency yet.
All right. Any questions of Ms. Lewis or Representative Fritz? Okay, we'll be checking in with admin, and I'll renew my motion for 37. Anyone to testify for or against the bill? Doesn't appear that there is. I'll renew my motion for lay it over for possible inclusion, House File 3788, and we'll let you know what we find out from admin.
Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Okay, we've got, is Junkie going to show up? Who's next? What do you want to do?
Simon.
Representative Simon here?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, there he is. Okay, Representative Simon. Didn't see you back there. Representative Simon, welcome, and the chair will move House File 3687 for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Lands Bill, and no amendments, so Representative Simon, to your bill.
First of all, Mr. Chair and members, thank you very, very much personally for giving us a hearing on very short notice and very crowded time. We'll try to be quick. I'm here with and on behalf of a constituent, Jeff Carlson, whose family's treasured piece of land was taken in the mid-70s by the DNR. And I don't, members, I'm not an expert in this area. I'm in your hands, and so is my constituents here, and you'll do the right thing, and you'll do what you need to do with this. But it seems to me from hearing from Mr. Carlson, you'll hear from him in a minute, that many of the reasons given for why the land was originally needed, if they ever existed, no longer exist. And as recently as 2 weeks ago, Mr. Carlson was up near the land and had some very interesting conversations with folks around there who, according to his telling of the story, basically admit that the land is no longer needed to be owned by the state. So I'll turn it over to the folks who know it best, and Mr. Chair and members, if you listen to Mr. Carlson, I think he has something to say about this.
Welcome, Mr. Carlson, to the committee. Go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Jeff Carlson. I really appreciate you allowing me this time to speak here. This battle's been going on since 1968, actually. I'd like to thank you for allowing me to represent our family in this case of what we feel is eminent domain abuse and abuse of power by the Minnesota DNR. My father purchased our property in 1948, put two cabins on it, and named it Sleepy Hollow. He used it to teach many Boy Scout troops, family, and friends to hunt, fish, camp, love, and to give back to nature. In 1975, after a seven-year battle, the state took Sleepy Hollow away from our family and friends. The reason they gave was for them to add on to the Spire Valley Trout Hatchery. This was never done. The property has been off limits to the public and my family for over 30 years for no good reason. We do, in fact, have a letter from Tim Henning, who is a staffer for the DNR, stating that nobody is allowed on that property, that was written to my cousin in 2006. This past year, we finally got a meeting with the DNR, and every single reason they gave for their continued control of the Sleepy Hollow property, we were able to discredit. And now they're just down to the only reason that they'll give us now is that we're just not willing to give up any property. And as I understand it, there's 16 other bills right now, land bills going on with the DNR for selling and acquiring property. So I don't think that holds water either. The DNR has strung us along and lied to everyone, from myself to the governor, about the reasons for taking and keeping this property. To the shame of the DNR, over the years, the trout stream has been allowed to fill in with sand from the power line clearing. They've burned down our two cabins and left the debris still rotting on the ground. They've blocked the only two legitimate accesses to the property and posted it against access. so it has not been open for public use. Last month, while I was up at the property taking pictures, the current operator of the Spire Valley Fish Hatchery approached me. We introduced ourselves. His name is Gary. He asked me why we didn't accept the offer of 20 acres across the road from Sleepy Hollow. And I explained to him we weren't made that offer, and that was the first I'd ever heard of it. By the end of our extensive conversation about the whole matter, Gary told me he didn't see any reason why the Carlsons shouldn't be given the property back. Now, Gary Mattson is the one person that Dave Shad, director for the DNR Fisheries, used as an expert and used Gary's opinion to not sell us the property. Gary formed his opinion by way of false statements and information given to him by Dave Shad and Ron Payer, another director. Gary was told we intended to build our own trout hatchery or pump water out of the aquifer bottle and sell it. These ideas keep surfacing from Dave Shad, and we have no idea where they come from. We want to rebuild our cabin and sleep in it. You know, end of story. My family has been deprived use of Sleepy Hollow property and cabin for 33 years for no legitimate reasons. Nothing can make up for the time we lost or the fact my father died before we could have it returned to us. But you can help by making things right now, by seeing it returned to us. My family owning this property again will in no way negatively affect the operation of the hatchery, Scout Camp Pond, or the legal use of any of the surrounding public land. I've distributed pictures of the property when we owned it, and pictures since it was, the DNR is taking control of it, and some notes of the history of the property and the battle that we've had to get it back. Please feel free at any time to contact me with any questions you have on this matter. I have my phone number here, my email address, and I have a website that kind of goes over the whole situation. It's mndnrabuse.com. And if you'd like to look over any of the pictures or any of the other information and have a question, I'd be more than happy to answer anything for you.
Okay, questions on Bertha Meckmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe, Mr. Chair, this is a question for you. I'm curious, two things. What year did the DNR take it, and at what price? And then do we have an idea of what the repurchase price would be for the family?
Well, we're going to have, why don't, if you can answer that.
Or the DNR, whatever.
The property was, the eminent domain proceeding started in 1968, and my father fought him until 75 when he finally, I think, spent more money than what he got for the property. We were given $7,800 for 23 acres and two cabins, and $400 for the mineral rights. And on a sidebar to that, I don't really think if something is not for sale, if it's a treasure and you don't want to sell it, I don't think there is a price. It's fair. And you can think of some of your own things that you have that's handed down from your families, or there's things that just are not for sale.
Well, you should live up by the boundary waters in Boyd's Park. Then you'd really get a real taste for this. Representative McNamara, you have any further questions on that?
That's good.
Other members have questions. Let's hear from the DNR.
The history, we'll be able to get back to you in a moment.
Okay. Welcome, Mr. Fire.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members, Ron Player, DNR Fish and Wildlife. And the property was taken by condemnation in 1975. Mr. Carlson was right on the price. It was taken, I think the condemnation proceedings were for fish-rearing purposes. Spire Valley is our sole brook trout source for stocking inland waters of brook trout. And I think in our position might be most clearly stated by a letter that Director Dave Shad sent back in April of 07, where removing the track from public ownership would threaten the integrity of the Spire Valley hatchery, resulting in a loss of public recreational opportunities and cause a gap in a corridor of protected habitat. As such, we continue to maintain that the property serves an important public purpose, and your client's request to release the above caption land from public ownership is respectfully denied. And the one of the concerns is with the aquifer, and if there's wells drilled there, then they're free-flowing wells, and that was tried before. It is a there's about 964 feet of designated trout stream. And it is, I'm not aware of any case where we've turned the public away. I know it's used for both angling and hunting. So that pretty much states our position on the around this.
So, Ms. Fire, you bought it to build a hatchery on, or you bought it so that you could protect the river, or both?
Mr. Chairman, what I see on this, in 1975, it was for fish-rearing purposes to help maintain the overall facility, and I'm not aware of what the plans might have been or what was conveyed at that point in time.
Representative McNamara.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Pyer, so you're not in a position to dispute the testifier's testimony that his family was told it was still the hatchery?
Mr. Chairman, Representative McNamara, what was in the condemnation proceedings was for fish rearing. That's what the language says.
So, did you have another question, Representative McNamara?
Well, I think your look is the same as mine. If we meant to build a hatchery, we didn't build a hatchery. We ought to be giving it back to the family and figure out what the fair value is today from 1975. And I just did some quick math, and it was $75,000 at the 7% return. So, I don't know what the price is. That was my next thing.
And you know, let me ask another question, Ms. Pryor. Mr. Carlson referenced that one of the DNR employees, I forget who it was, he could probably tell us, said that why didn't they take some land in trade for that? What light can you shed on that testimony?
Mr. Chairman, I think Mr. Carlson's referring to Gary Matson. He's the hatchery supervisor in Fire Valley. And I'm not aware of any conversations that we've had regarding a land exchange. I'm just not aware of anything.
Okay, and so I guess, Representative McNamara, when you get down to fish, for fish rearing purposes, not being an attorney, my first blush at that is that you're going to raise fish, not protect the stream. Are you and I on the same frequency on that?
Well, Mr. Chair, you and I both happen to be old enough to have been around in 1975. Unfortunately, the DNR wasn't buying a lot of land to preserve the habitat then, as much as maybe it would have been a good thing, but they were periodically buying property to put them into businesses such as fish rearing. So, I mean, if we had some documentation where we were buying it to preserve the habitat. But I got to believe the testifier, he said there was reason to believe it was for a hatchery, which is consistent with what I'm thinking, and that's why I wanted to ask Director Pryor. And so my point would be, if we made a mistake, we ought to correct it now, but I also believe it should be at a relatively fair value determined by what they paid. I don't really care what the market is today, unless it was less than what the money would have. I mean, if they were to go invest the money at 7% or whatever, I got $82,000. And some may say, well, my goodness gracious, that's 10 times the amount. But the reality is that would be a very reasonable return. And the reality, most lakeshore, rivershore property has certainly gone up in value faster than 7%. So I don't know.
Especially with all the brook trout and the swimming in the state, and that sounds like it's pretty important.
Well,
and Ms. Fire, could you give us the chair and Mr. Fidelka a copy of that condemnation order so we can actually read the language that's in there in the order?
Mr. Chairman, I will do that.
Okay. And Mr. Olson, correct?
Carlson.
Carlson, I'm sorry. Would you like to add anything? We're not in a position here where we're refuting things, but we're just trying to get some clarification on some of this stuff. I took from your testimony that it was represented to you and your family that they were going to build a fish hatchery there.
Yes, sir. Mr. Chairman,
when they told you it was for fish rearing, what did that mean to you?
They told my father they were going to build a fish hatchery there, which in my conversation with Gary Matson, that was one of the things that came up. He said they could not use that for raising fish because you have to be able to drain a fish pond, and you can't drain a beaver pond. And as far as the people using it, in the pictures you can see the condition of the land. And Gary said that in 2006 they electroshocked the whole 2.3 miles of the creek and found only 8 fish in it. And when we owned the property, there was abundance of sunfish, crappies, bass, northern. And Gary Madsen agreed with me that at this point, the only thing that lives in there are large northerns, a few suckers, and some escaped trout that the northerns eat.
Mr. Meyer, welcome.
And, excuse me?
Mm-hmm.
And he also said that, to the best of his knowledge, only 2 to 3 times a year somebody ever goes fishing on that pond.
Okay, Mr. Meyer, welcome.
Mr. Chair, members of the record, Bob Meyer, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Natural Resources. To the question, in 1969, Chapter 733, actually the legislature discussed this issue and passed a law that says game and fish spawning areas, acquisition of certain land. And it provides the Commissioner of Administration may acquire by gift, purchase, or condemnation proceedings under Minnesota statutes any or all of the lands described in this section for the spawning areas designated. I can get you a copy of this if you want. With this bill and the next one, I believe, Mr. Chair, it's yours, perhaps these issues are better taken up in the Claims Committee rather than in the Lands Committee, since I think some people perceive this as a taking when we were actually authorized by the legislature to acquire the land, and perhaps these discussions should take place in that committee.
Well, could you read me that one more time, please, just so I get to hear it a second time? I'm a little slow.
It's Chapter 733 of Minnesota Laws, 1969, and the title is an act authorizing the Commissioner for Administration to acquire by gift, purchase, or condemnation proceedings certain lands for spawning purposes. And then it says, Section 1, game fish spawning areas, acquisition of certain lands. It lists out those lands, and it includes Fire Valley Trout Raising Facility. But I think the intention of the discussion in that time was that a facility not only includes a building, but also includes, especially for a trout raising facility, waters and water appropriation.
Could you provide that to Mr. Kadelka then, so we can have the, we're kind of assembling right there, McNamara?
Assistant Commissioner Meyer, so is it your thoughts that, or do we have any documentation that we weren't acquiring the land to build a hatchery there? I mean, are you saying it may have been just to protect the stream? I'm not sure I understood, because the testifier is saying that he was under the impression his father was told it was to build a hatchery.
Mr. Chair, Representative McNamara, I wish there was an opportunity for us to go back and listen to the tapes when this discussion occurred in the legislature. To me, a fish-rearing facility includes perhaps a building which is the Fire Valley Fish Hatchery Facility there, but also protecting the water resources for raising of those trout. The facility does use groundwater to breed and raise those trout, which is one of our main concerns about selling this piece of land. A water appropriation that may occur from the groundwater would interrupt and could possibly force us to shut down that fish hatchery.
President Magmer?
Okay.
Anything else, Mr. Meyer?
No, sir.
Mr. Carlson? Mr. Chairman? According to Gary Madsen, Gary Madsen is the man that Dave Shad used to say that this sale couldn't go through. And one of the reasons he somehow figured we were going to bottle the water and sell it. According to Gary, he said any well drilled on that property that was at least 4 feet above the static head of the aquifer would in no way, no matter what happened, could not have any negative effect on that aquifer. The reason that the other well had to be capped is they drilled it down well into the aquifer and it started to leak. And so they had to cap that. There's absolutely no way a well drilled above the static head of that aquifer could negatively affect it in any way.
Representative Simon, anything you'd like to add to this?
No, just thanks again to the committee. You know, we're in your hands here, but this is one determined guy. I can tell you this, and I had the email to prove it. I mean, it really means something to him. I hope he can pick that up today. And I know there are a lot of people in his situation, but he's got a ton of family here today because something that belonged to them was taken from them, and they think it was under, you know, less than honest circumstances. And maybe at one time it was more honest than it is today, but what he's telling me and telling you is that as recently as a couple of weeks ago, he had folks who know what they're talking about saying that there's no reason this can't go back to him. So I ask you to consider that.
Representative Simpson, you have a question?
Just to take off of what the Assistant Commissioner said, Representative Simon, have you looked at taking this to the Claims Department?
Representative Simon.
Mr. Chair, no, I hadn't thought about that. I used to serve on the Claims Committee. I don't know whether this would be a precise fit or not. It seems like a better fit here than there. You know better than I would, but in my time, my one term on the Claims Committee, I don't think we ever saw a land sale. It doesn't mean it didn't happen before. It seems to me like a better fit, but that's really your call.
Thank you. Well, members, you're going to hear another bill in a moment that is going to frost your cake as well. So I just have to tell you, Representative Simon, Mr. Carlson, my tolerance for things that look and smell like this are pretty low. We have done battle with the federal government most of my life over land in Voyageurs National Park that ended up not being condemned, but my parents finally bowed over to the federal government and sold out at a fraction of what that land is worth, especially today. And so at least this chair, you have their ear. And I'm certain that the DNR is not going to be happy about what I might do, but I'm certain that you've had quite a number of years of unhappiness as well. So we'll see where this ends up.
Thank you.
Anybody to testify, other persons to testify for or against the bill? There being none, the chair will lay over House File 3687 for possible inclusion. Thank you very much for coming, Mr. Carlson. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you for your time and my family. My friend Dave, also thank you.
Okay, Representative Junkie, did he show up? Somebody looking for him?
I was looking for him.
Okay. All right. Okay, members. House File, this is a bill that I've authored, House File 3897, so I'll move it to come before us to be possible inclusion for the Omnibus Lands Bill. Members, now I'm going to give you what I understand, and I received some more information here today. But up in Crane Lake, a person all the way back in the 30s and 20s owned a considerable amount of real estate, almost all lakeshore, thousands and thousands and thousands of shoreline feet. He was kind of the founder of the community. His name was John G. Hanberg. And he was a forester by trade. That was his trade. But as an additional building or an additional business, he and his family established a general store and a U.S. post office, the first U.S. post office in Crane Lake, and a marina and a resort. And out of the goodness of his heart, in 1936, and I have the deed here, and I'll get it around to everybody so that they can see it for themselves. He gave to the DNR about 2.4 acres, somewhere between 500 and 700 shoreline feet of land as well, for use as a forestry station. And on the deed to the state of Minnesota was a reversionary clause. Now, this was in 1936. Was a reversionary clause that stated that if it were to be discontinued as a forestry location, that the family had the ability to buy back the land for $50 from the state, which is the same amount that he paid for the land, $50. So Mr. Hanberg operated his resort next door to it, and the DNR established their forestry station soon thereafter. And all things went well until about 1980, thereabouts, when the department announced that they were going to discontinue the forestry station there. So the family went to their family attorney. Coincidentally, it happens to be my family attorney's firm, still, and said, "We want our land back." My great-grandfather, now we're to the fourth generation now, who owns the land, says, "We want our land back."
and they said, well, we'll get it back. So they started the proceeding to get it back, told the DNR they wanted it back, and then the short of it is the DNR said, no, you don't get it back, because in 1946 the legislature passed the Marketable Titles Act, and one of the provisions, I think we passed it out, the Marketable Titles Act, referring to affecting title of real estate, it's 541.023, states that if you don't refile your covenant every 40 years, you lose the land and all claim, or you lose the claim that's in the covenant that was listed on the deed, which I have a copy of the deed right here. Says essentially what I said it says. So here you have 1936, when there was no internet. I don't even know if there was phone in Crane Lake in 1936. I know when I was a kid, in the 60s, we had to ring it up, and it was the party lines and all kinds. I don't even know if there was forms of communication. What type of forms there were. And so this Marketable Titles Act was passed in the 40s, 46. And these people went through four generations of people thinking that when the forestry discontinued their use, if they ever did, that they'd be able to buy the land back as long as they were running a resort next door to it. Well, they went to court over this, and I've got the proceedings here. And the court found that they didn't have any claim. Well, sure they wouldn't have any claim because the statute says they don't have any claim. Because it was passed in 1946, 10 years after they did the deal, and who even knew about it? I mean, how many citizens in this room know about all these statutes that get passed and are in our blue book? I mean, I see Representative Simpson shaking his head. Now, no, I see him shaking his head, no. And so the DNR, what they did was, now imagine this. Next door to this piece of 2.4 acres is a resort and a marina. And it's the oldest Johnson Evinrude outboard dealership in the United States. Almost 70 years they've been selling boats and motors and running a resort and a marina. In fact, it's about a 350 to 400 boat marina today, where they have slips and people. I know, Representative Corney, if you've been there, to this very location. Now, let me tell you what they did. Not only did they take the land, but they built a free boat launching ramp next door to it on the land that they got from the family next to the people who are selling the same product with taxpayer money. We went in competition. Not only were we in competition, we're giving it away for free. Now, tell me that that's right. Now, this land is probably worth, well, they say on Lake Vermilion it's worth $3,000 a foot. We're kind of in the low rent district up at Crane Lake, so let's just say it's worth $1,500 a foot. We're talking well over $1 million in today's numbers. Now, to top it off, one step further, ever since they built the boat launching ramp, it's not been big enough, even though it's huge. It's big, isn't it, Representative Cornish? It's big. And the DNR has got this great big huge boathouse, the wet boathouse that they drive the enforcement boats in. Representative Cornish, I'm sure you've driven a boat in and out of it.
Number of times.
Not only did they build the boat launching facility and give away the product for free that the people that gave them the land are charging for it immediately next door, but now, since 1985, they've been pestering them trying to buy more land so they can expand the thing and put in more free boat launching. Now, what's right about that? Of course, the family says, we're not selling anymore. We got out of the first bunch of land. We're not going to sell you any more land so you can expand and be in competition with us. Now, in accordance with the law, the department's right, the judgment is right, everything is right. But I'm asking you, what is right? That someone could, out of the goodness of their heart, give the land to the department, put on a reversionary clause. 10 years later, the legislature down here passes a bill that says that if you don't refile in 40 years, you lose all claim to it. 40 years after, 40 plus years later, the family, the DNR discontinues the forestry, which is specifically says what they can do on the land. And the DNR has the land and then goes in competition with them and doesn't even charge for it, gives it away. So what this bill does, as drafted, says that the department will, one, give the land back, which I assume would be with all the improvements.
So they certainly would charge for the boat launching if they had the boat launching ramp, and they'd have plenty of business for it. Number two is that they convey an equal amount of land, including shoreline footage, to the family from somewhere else, even on another lake for that matter. And, or number, I guess number one was that they pay fair market value at today's price. So first thing is fair market value. Second one is conveying land of equal value to them at another location. So that's what the bill does. And so what I'm asking you members, and we're going to lay the bill over, but I want you to think about this. I mean, eventually, somebody's got to do something right. You just can't run over people. And sure, they didn't know that the Marketable Titles Act got passed. I mean, go home and ask them how many people have ever heard of the Marketable Titles Act, or for that matter, pick any one of those statutes in those blue books and go home and ask one person to recite one statute out of one of those blue books and see what you get. Now, Mr. Meyer is going to get up here and tell us all about why we shouldn't be considering what we're considering. I mean, sometime, Representative Simpson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think you've obviously told a good story, and there's probably a lot of credibility to it. And as a free market guy, I have a real problem with the guy running a resort next door to a government agency, because it isn't to the level of playing field. But I would assume the guy with the resort complex is probably paying a bit of taxes on that, and probably paying a lot of maintenance upkeep So you're absolutely correct. It is a kind of an unusual circumstance. So I think it'll be interesting to hear what Mr. Myers has to say and where do we take it from here.
Mr. Myers, welcome.
Mr. Chair, members of the record, again, Bob Meyer, DNR. I believe you did refer the court case dated May 1, 1981, where this issue was discussed and heard up in Hibbing, Minnesota, and they did find in favor of the state that there was no interest that would carry forward. So we feel this issue has been discussed. The courts have decided. Of course, the legislature can certainly pass a law undoing that or doing whatever you want it to do. Just to the note on the improvements that are there, on the deed, it says that in any event, all improvements of whatever nature placed thereon by the grantee shall be and remain its property and subject to the sale and removal only by the grantee, state of Minnesota. So if this law were to take effect and we were to take the option of conveying them back the land, we would then try to figure out what we do with those improvements, either sell, remove them, replace them on some other facility. So the improvements would not go along with the property. We would have to figure out what we do, maybe sell the parking lot at the cost that's there right now. This is a boat access on one of the lakes up there, larger lakes that we're looking for so desperately to place on those lakes that are up in that chain of lakes. Lake Mammillion, Lake Capitoga, Manamakan, Crane, Mille Lacs, Winnie are large lakes. We need safe harbors, safe access. So, while I do understand the chair's passion for this issue and the issues like that to take place, there's nothing I can do to change the past. And I apologize for this. I shouldn't apologize. I'm not going to apologize for the legislature passing a law in 1945 changing these conditions. But we feel having it being discussed in the court system and the state coming out ahead on that it is our position to own and maintain that property. And any improvements, if this law were to take place or go into effect, would remain to be the state of Minnesota's property.
So I'm to Mr. Meyer's point, this is my bill. I'm not repeating that the court case, the judge absolutely did the right thing. He went by what the law said, that the 40 years had expired. What I'm saying is you guys didn't do the right thing, and you were backed up by a law that no one knew about, no one had a clue about, and how could they possibly know? And my question to you, Mr. Meyer, is did the department ever notify the people that had the generosity of those folks? Did they have any obligation to notify them that there was a reversionary clause out there on a piece of property and that the legislature had passed a law and said, Representative Lagini, if you're a lawyer, you know about these things. I mean, you've got
a really horrible set of circumstances here that has cost this family well over $1 million in value of their land, and has been for the benefit. And frankly, I'm fine with the boat launching ramp. I don't like the idea of it being next door to a place that pays for it, but they survived it. But it just gets down to what's right. And how many more times is this going to be duplicated over the course of history here? So anyway, anybody have any more questions or statements? Mayor McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Assistant Commissioner, is there any other examples of folks that wish they would have known what happened in 1945? And has any previous legislature ever said, you know, sorry you didn't know and granted? I see this as potentially opening up a huge can of worms. I agree that I'm troubled by what happened, but I'm just wondering, this must have affected a lot of places and a lot of people, and I would think there's been some other people that have been, I mean, this might be a very blatant one where they're going into direct competition and using the land for something different, but has there been other people before the legislature that you're aware of?
Mr. Chair, Representative McNamara, not that we're aware of. I mean, this is the first issue of this type that has come across our desk, and checking with Kathy Lewis from Lands and Minerals, they aren't aware of that either. And there are laws and rules that change every day that affect people's lives. We do the best we can in making sure people understand those. And when we can change things, we'll do that on occasion. But in this issue, it's a very complex and, frankly, relatively costly conservation-wise or monetary-wise to do what this bill would do.
Well, Representative McNamara, here's what happened. In 1980, or whatever year it was, right in that neighborhood, 80, 81, the department was desperate to get a public access on Crane Lake because all the land is privately owned. That's where the road comes to. They would do anything to get a public access. And instead of doing the right thing and saying, you know, we're going to quit this for four, all they had to do was just keep a forestry office there and build a boat launching ramp. That's all they had to do. But they didn't. They closed down the building, tore it down, tore out the septic system, ripped the entire thing out and blacktopped the entire 2.4 acres and went in competition with the neighbors. Exactly in the opposite of the deed that was filed in 1936 on this land. So they didn't do anything right. And that's the reason that this bill is before us. And I'm telling you, as long as I'm in the legislature, if these things keep coming up, you're going to keep paying if I can get it done. Because it's not right. Too many people have lost too much. And Representative Hansen, you had a question?
Representative McNamara.
Okay, any further discussion? Anyone want to testify? And I didn't bring them down here because the prison owner is on a ventilator and they're over 70 years old and they're still trying to get this done right. And the next generation is now running the resort and the boat launching ramp and the 300 plus boat marina next door. And I will bring them down here and I'll have them here with a tear in their eye and him sucking the juice out of his throat with a vacuum cleaner that he does every 5 minutes. And then we'll see where we go with this. So with that, any anybody want to testify for or against the bill? All right, we'll lay it over for possible inclusion. House file, whatever the number is, 3897. Riverdale Junkie, you're here?
About that bill, Representative.
And Representative Peterson, you've been there too.
Yes, I've been there.
But I've had you there, Representative Peterson.
I've been there. I know exactly what you're talking about.
Welcome, Representative Junkie. The Carroll Move House, File 3678.
Thank you.
It's possible inclusion.
And I'm glad this place is all warmed up before I got here. That's very nice. Mr. Chair and members, this came to me and my attention at the West Central Dark House Association meeting. One of the members came up and said, you got to fix something for us. I said, what's that? He said, well, I had my nephew, I think it was his nephew, come in from Wisconsin. He wanted to go spearing with him out on the lake, and they went to buy a license, and they wouldn't sell him one. I said, you got to be kidding. He said, no, you can't buy an out-of-state license to spear in Minnesota. I said, you got to be kidding. He said, no. And so I checked with the DNR, and I said, why? They didn't know why. No one knows why. It's a revenue maker, enhancer, to sell licenses at the outstate rate, and that's what this has in here.
And that's all we're asking, is that, like everything else, you allow outstate people to enjoy the sports we enjoy here, as far as fishing and hunting. That's the bill.
Questions on the bill?
Representative Junkie, do you know, thank you, Mr. Chair, if can Minnesotan beer in North Dakota?
Representative Junkie,
I do not know.
Okay.
Why, you want to go over there?
No, I was just curious, because I think they just opened brewing up in North Dakota within the last few years.
I'm not sure, but I don't think the DNR is going to come down here anymore.
Well, yeah. It's fire.
I don't know if that's that answer.
You got to have a little fun.
Hopefully we reciprocate. I don't know what the rules are. I know the two-line fishing. If Mr. Cherry, you want to hear about two-line fishing, I know that.
No.
It's fire, welcome.
Mr. Chairman, members, Ron Player, Fish and Wildlife, DNR.
Welcome.
And I do not believe that Minnesotans can steer in North Dakota.
I didn't think so.
Well, maybe the goodwill of this bill will allow that to happen.
Sure. That'll start something. And Ms. Player, you have any other opinions on the bill?
Mr. Chairman, Minnesota residents, not counting seniors who don't need a steering license, we sell between 15 and 20,000 steering licenses each year. So a non-resident license probably wouldn't be a huge number of folks. So it's probably a fairly minimal fiscal issue, more of a social issue than it is a fiscal or fish management issue.
And I contend it won't be a lot fiscally, but it will be a plus. There will be some sold.
Okay. Anyone else like to testify on the bill? Okay. Anyone from the audience like to testify on the bill? House File 3678, laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, members.
Yep.
The bill, Mr. Chair.
And the next bill is House File 3898, which is another bill authored by me, another crucify the Department of Natural Resources bill that's before it. And the chair has an amendment, the 1322X amendment. Everyone have the amendment? It's being handed out right now. So we'll just wait a moment so I can explain the amendment. And the motion will be House File 3898, recommended to pass and back to the Committee on Environment and Natural Resources, which is Representative Eakin. And Mr. Epperly, I'm sure you'll want to come on. You'll be testifying on this bill. Or Mr. Tomlinson. Okay, Chair will move the 1322X amendment to get the bill in the shape that the author wants it. In favor of the bill, of the amendment, say aye. Opposed?
Aye.
Motion prevails. Okay, House File 3898 is amended. Members, what the bill does is, from time to time, members, the DNR makes a mistake. I know it's hard to believe, but from time to time they make a mistake. Well, in the case of timber sales, after we did quite a bit of relief last year for the loggers in our timber relief bill, there was a sale up in Orr. Just so happened coincidentally in my community. And the department was putting up their sales of each tract as they normally do, by tract and by number. And a tract number, I'm going to give an example, number 10 came up. And there was a bid for the opening appraised value of the wood. And a logger A bid appraised. And normally the increases are done in 1% increments, as I understand. So logger B bid 1% above appraised. So logger A bid 2%. And they went back and forth, and they went to 39% over the appraised value, as I understand the number. 39% over. And I actually think it was two particular sales they were bidding on, and they both went up to 39. Anyway, the amount of money was $40,000 more than appraised for the wood. After it was over, the department announced, and we'll hear if I've got it pretty close, the department announced that bidder B was not a qualified bidder. And so the bidder A, who was the qualified bidder, said, well, geez, I just got bid up 39% over appraised by a guy that shouldn't even be here.
So I want the wood. I opened the bidding. I want the wood for the first qualified bid, which was 39, which was 40 grand less in essence, essentially an estimated $40,000 thereabouts. So the department came along and said, he called me up on the phone and says, you know, this isn't right. And so the department said, well, we've got a law that says, a statute that says if there's a mistake made, we can just cancel the bid. We can just cancel the sale. I said, well, wait a minute, that isn't right, because he came all the way down here to bid on the sale. He was prepared to bid. He bid. He got bid up 39% over, and the other guy wasn't qualified. So then the department said, well, fine, we'll give you the sale, but you have to pay 39% over. And if you don't do it, if you don't take the sale at 39% over, then we'll just put it up for bid again. So the logger said, well, geez, I don't want to do that, because now the other bidder will be qualified, and this wood is really located in a spot that's ideal for both of us, and he'll just bid me up some more. And now I'll be going competition and bid against him again. It'll cost me more money to get it. So he took the sale and he paid the 39% over, which I heard was about $40,000. So the first provision of this bill is that the section applies in the case of a public auction conducted in June of 07 on an open bid process where the bidder was later found ineligible. The commissioner shall refund to the qualified purchaser the difference between what he paid and what he should have paid. Now, I mean, come on. Think about it in your own pocketbook. You go to an auction, you buy a car at an auction, and somebody's there that doesn't even have a pocketbook. And he bids you up $5,000 more than the opening bid, and then he walks around, gets in the car, and drives off. Oh, I don't have any money. What's the difference between those two scenarios? This guy wasn't qualified. I could not. I worked all summer to resolve this with the department. They wouldn't budge. So that's the reason for the bill. The second part is maybe a little less controversial, although we'll have to hear from Representative Wagenius. $50,000 is appropriated in fiscal 09 for Forest Management Incentive Account to the Forest Resources Council to conduct a study of options to make recommendations to the legislature addressing fragmentation and partialization of private lands. This is something that the Forest Resource Council is working on an ongoing basis. We've talked about it in these committees many times. So with that, questions from the members.
Chairman.
On House File 3898 as amended. Rep. Zimmo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I weigh into this with some apprehension. Were there any other bidders in this particular sale?
Well, we can hear from DNR, but the way it was represented to me is there were two bidders, the qualified bidder and the non-qualified bidder.
Okay. And then just a kind of a broader question that maybe you can respond to, and maybe the department can too. If we're going to fix this for one case, and I've heard anecdotally of this kind of thing happening somewhere else. I mean, wouldn't it make sense for us to legislatively come up with a strategy that would prevent this from happening again?
And Representative Moe, I'm working on that, and so I'm hoping to send this bill out back to policy, and in the next day or so, I had originally some language, and we figured out that it didn't work.
Oh, okay.
And so between now and the policy committee, I'd hope to have another amendment that would put in law so that if this happened again, that they wouldn't have to come back here to get their money back. Welcome, Mr. Epperly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Dave Epperly, Director of Forestry, Minnesota DNR. Chairman Dill, you did give an accurate account of what occurred. A mistake was made, and an ineligible bidder was allowed to advance and bid. The question of whether there would have been other bidders is something of conjecture, and you wouldn't know as the nature of open auctions. You just don't know these things. But I think to the language that you have proposed, a couple of concerns. And one, I think it would be fixing the situation that you have, but it might inadvertently allow other bidders to be able to bid things up in the same manner, knowing that they might get the bid later on by default. And that's a concern, and I think we could work through these details. The nature of open auctions are interesting. If you've ever attended one, they can get a little bit fast-paced. And in this particular case, a mistake was made by allowing an ineligible bidder to move forward. As I understand how that happened was the bidder had said that they had the proper paperwork and were able to produce that. They should have had it there. We should have required to have it there. They were taken at their word, I believe, and were unable to produce it. So the typical policy that we have in a situation like that is to reject the bid and reoffer. And that's where the issue came up, I think, because of the desire to have the wood at the time. But, so.
Thank you, Mr. Epley. Could you characterize for the committee? It was held at Orr City Hall. The City Hall is about from the corner of that corner over to that clock, the building area. Could you characterize how many people might have been there to bid on those sales? When you say there might have been another bidder. Now, my recollection is from being there many times during the bidding process, there's usually 20, 30, 40 people that are qualified to bid. Would that be an accurate description of that day?
Yes, Mr. Chair, that would be accurate.
So the idea that there might have been another bidder, there sure as heck were a lot of other bidders there, but only two people bid on the sale, one qualified and one unqualified. So other questions by the committee? Representative Lugenius.
I think I'm not getting something here. You said typically in a situation where there's an unqualified bidder that you reject and reoffer. But you didn't in this circumstance, and I didn't understand why.
Representative Lugenius, what I meant was is typically an ineligible bidder would be recognized right up front. That didn't happen. And so he was assumed to be an eligible bidder. The bidding took place. Now the bid was flawed because later on the bidder was found out to be ineligible. At that point in time, policy is usually it's a flawed bid, it's rejected, and it's reoffered at a later auction.
Representative Gaines.
So I'm not getting it. Why wasn't this rejected and reoffered at a later auction?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lugenius, it was proposed to be rejected and offered, and that's when the issue that's before you started to occur. In the fairness, the eligible bidder said that he would have likely gotten that bid at appraised and felt that there were no other bidders against him, and that's the issue at hand.
And Representative Guinea, if he didn't feel that there were no other bidders, there were no other bidders. And I feel that they haven't answered the question that you've asked yet. Representative Guinea.
Why didn't you reject and rebid? It's just because that is your policy.
Chairman Gill and Representative Guinea, we offered to do that very thing, but the individual desired to keep the bid.
Ms. Tomlinson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lugenius, Bob Tomlinson with DNR. I think point of clarification here is that the ineligible bidder was not actually the high bidder. And had that person been the high bidder, we would have withdrawn that bid from there and reoffered it at a later time. The ineligible bidder was the one that pushed up the high bidder, as Representative Gill suggested in the beginning. And so the eligible bidder, which is actually the high bidder, was suggesting that the bid process was flawed. But he was indeed the high bidder, and we told him at that point, you can either keep the wood at the bid up price that you paid, or you can't, we'll take the wood and reoffer it again at a future auction, in which time you can then come in and compete in the bid process.
You gave him a choice, and the choice was, we can take it at what it was, or we can rebid it. And he chose to take it at what it was.
Mr. Chair, Representative McGinnis, that my understanding is that's the correct way it went. We gave him the option if he wanted to not take the bid, you know, that we would have voided the bid, voided the, that particular sale, I believe. This has been 7 months since we've talked about it, but I recall that that was part of the discussion. The high bidder, who was the eligible bidder, didn't want that. He wanted the bid at the lower appraised value. And we said we can't just do that. We need to re-auction the wood, and we felt we were following the law in that approach with it.
Representative Genius.
So you, but he then chose, and this is what we need to clarify, he then chose to tell you, don't re-auction, I'll take it at the higher price. Is that what happened?
Mr. Chair, Representative Genius, that my understanding is that is what's occurred. That is what's happened.
So he made a he essentially then made a contract with you at that point.
That's correct. We brought this to Representative Gill's attention. He brought it to our attention, and we kind of talked through it. But actually, he brought it to Representative Gill's attention and brought it to our attention. We talked through it before. I think that decision was probably made on it.
Representative Genius, on about July 10th, the DNR wrote him a letter and said, if you either take the wood for the higher price, or we're going to re-auction it, and you have 10 days to decide. And his the thinking of the logger is now the other fellow is a qualified bidder. And this wood happens to be strategically located. They both log for the same company, for the same paper company. And this wood is strategically located for both of them. They both happen to be located in almost the very near area. So he said, I got to take it at this high, at this bid-up price, because if I don't take it at the bid-up price, my competitor that was ineligible is going to come back in and bid it up some more. So I've got, you know, he says, I've got a gun to my head here. If I don't take it, I should get it at the first opening bid because no one else bid except the ineligible bidder. And now I'm forced to take it at 39% over, which accounted to somewhere in the neighborhood of $40,000 additional dollars. And I didn't do anything wrong except bid on the wood against somebody that wasn't qualified to bid. And you're right, he did eventually, but I mean, they sent him a letter and said, take it or leave it, 10 days, you decide. So he took it. He had to stay in business. Representative Virginia.
Well, I'm going to push back on a little bit on your use of the word he was forced to take it, because he made a grown-up choice, and he made a grown-up choice because he saw that, well, geez, if it gets out there again, this other guy's going to come in there, and he's going to take it, or he's going to make me pay even more. So, I'm having a little bit of difficulty seeing why he feels so wronged at this point.
Representative Moe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To Representative Wiggins' question, then I have a question for the DNR. You know, when loggers go to an auction, they don't have a choice generally, but then to come home with so much wood. I mean, they need to, otherwise they can't put their guys out there to work, you know, and they, so this particular logger, I'm sure, after securing the wood, he didn't have the option of buying something else, or if, you know, if this had been bid out, he would have just bid on something else. So I think, in fact, his hands were tied. He really didn't have a whole lot of choice, I'm guessing, in this particular case. I know the DNR sees that there's a challenge here. I mean, and I'm sure that you don't want this to happen in the future, it seems. But as it is now, it seems that the onus is upon the logger to try to make sure that the other bidders are qualified. Otherwise, he might be in a situation like this again. So I know Representative Dill is working on a legislative strategy to prevent this again. Would you support that? I mean, it seems to me you'd just as soon not come here and have to defend yourself against us in the future.
Mr. Chair, Representative Moe, you know, we do want it to be fair, and we don't want this to happen again, but the fact of the matter is, it is our responsibility to make sure the bidders are eligible. And in this particular case, it didn't happen. It doesn't happen often, and I can't think of another case. I haven't been with the DNR all that long, but it's the first time it's happened in 2 years in this particular circumstance.
And Representative Moe.
Well, Mr. Chairman, if you want to address that, I mean, that's fine. But I guess just in response, the point is, though, that the department determined that the other bidder wasn't eligible. And so when you're determining that the other bidder wasn't eligible, the successful bidder is the one that had to pay the price of that determination. And I think Representative Dale is correct that it shouldn't be his responsibility, or he shouldn't have to pay for it. So in general, I mean, it just seems to make sense that we come up with a solution that the onus is upon the department and the state, and not upon the guys going to the auction. Just, you know, because it's completely beyond their control.
And to that point, if the lobbyer is going to be responsible for determining who's qualified at the point where there's a bidder, and this logger would have had that ability because the department held the paperwork, not the other logger, he would have just sat there and said, opening bid, and shut his mouth. And then the other bidder would have bid, and he would have said, wait a minute, he's ineligible, he can't bid. And he would have got it for the appraised value. Look, folks, Representative Wagenius said he made a contract, he made a grown-up decision. The department makes mistakes. And it cost the guy $40,000 after we went through all those shenanigans last year passing a logger relief bill, and then they turn around less than a month later and make this mistake. I'm not upset that they made the mistake. I mean, they can make mistakes. I make mistakes. You make mistakes. But sometimes they got to own up to the mistake and say, look, we're going to give you the reward for the appraised value because we made a mistake. That's all I ask for as a legislator. But instead, we're here today debating this thing because they screwed up and they won't admit it. Well, they'll admit it, but they're not going to do a damn thing about it. So, you know, my mother said, you'll never do wrong by doing right. Well, when is the department, you've got the land, you're taking people's land, you take it. How far do we have to go before we jerk a knot in the tail over there?
Representative Mr. Meyer.
Chair, members, for the record, Bob Meyer, Assistant Commissioner, and I take offense with some of your comments there. We try to do all we can the best way possible. There's a lot of things we do, and we do make mistakes. But in this case, we did all we can to deal with this individual. We offered to take the wood back. We made an offer to sell it over the counter. Of course, he would be the first one in line. He didn't want to do that. We've now changed our bidding process to make sure that everybody is approved 4 days or more before the bidding process starts. They can sign up on the website. We have a list. We go to those auctions with a list of all of our certified bidders, so this will not happen again. As I said previously on several of the other bills, perhaps this is a bill that needs to be referred, an issue that needs to be referred to the Claims Committee dealing with the $40,000 issue. We did try to make right with that logger. We had another auction, I believe, that was coming up in September. This was in July. September was our next auction that was coming up. We were going to put this right advance to the next one that was going to come up that day. Everybody makes mistakes, Mr. Chair. We always try to do the best we can. You may have seen several weeks ago, we did openly recognize he made a mistake and gave a gentleman back a fish that he caught. Now, that wasn't an easy decision for us to do. There were some people in the department who were very concerned about that, but the commissioners thought that we set a person up to fail. And by doing so, he wanted to make it right. In those situations where we do set someone up to fail, we want to do whatever we can to make it right. We tried working with this individual. Representative Moore, you're absolutely right. The wood was probably the most important thing that he needed. We tried to do what we could to make that right for him. But I understand your feelings, Mr. Chair, but to come across that way, I think, does not do the employees of the department justice. So with that, we are trying to do what we can to deal with these issues that are out there, trying to set up processes that are effective, and I'll just end my comments there.
Representative McNamara.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and having been involved in competitive bid and knowing all the pressure and those that are involved in that, I certainly respect a lot of the opinions and have been involved in spots where, unfortunately, public entities have made mistakes that can cost an individual, you know, a lot of money, or, you know, as Representative Moe said, in this case, you know, the ability to keep their employees at work or something. I've got a couple of questions along the line. I heard reference that the bidder was ineligible, but then I think I heard the chair say that potentially would be eligible now. Can I ask, why was the person ineligible, and is it possible, if he would have been the high bidder, could he have been, could he have reconciled his eligibility where he could have gotten the wood, and what makes him ineligible?
Mr. Chair, members, I checked with our timber sale supervisor just before we came over here this afternoon. Basically told me that there are two things relative to eligibility. Number one is that the bid on timber, you have to be registered with the state as an eligible bidder. In order to do that, as Mr. Meyer indicated there, you go to the website, there's a form there apparently you can apply online. You have to do it, you have to become eligible at least 4 days prior to. And one of the eligibility criteria is that you have to have the log safe certification. And then in order to operate the sale later on, there's additional responsibility that you have to meet some additional training requirements and things like that. But just the bid, you have to have registered with the state as an eligible, as a bidder, and you have to basically show that you've had that log safe certification.
Well, thank you, Assistant Director. And either Assistant Director Tomlinson or Director Epperly, if the ineligible bidder would have been the high bidder, would have the department been able to help him become eligible and be successful, or would you have, under current law, would have had to, you would not have been able to sell the wood to him? I mean, evidently a mistake was made and he got the bid on wood that, I'm assuming physically he shouldn't have been able to raise his hand, or you would have noted, you're ineligible, I'm sorry, sir, ma'am, you can't bid. But if after the fact, would there have been a way that you would have been able to allow him to get his bonds or to take the safety classes and acquire the wood?
Mr. Chair, Representative McNamara, we would do whatever we can to help someone become an eligible bidder. But with that said, we would have had to void the sale as well on the day of the auction. We, you know, we wouldn't be able to sell it to him.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I know this is a very tough one, and I'm glad it's not my constituent that you're having to deal
this
with.
This isn't my constituent.
Or in my expertise with the logging. The other thing that I think is important for folks to know, and Mr. Chair, you said it yourself, there was approximately, I was assuming there was only the two people in the city hall, but you're saying there was a number of people. And if I'm not mistaken, the other eligible loggers would have seen the two bidding back and forth, I would imagine, and they would have stayed out, as oftentimes is the case in any kind of an auction, until you get to where you see it going. So I don't know if it would be fair to assume that the other ones would not have bid on the logs if the two wouldn't have been bidding, and everybody would have assumed they were, right? I don't know whether the department can do anything different than what you did do. Along Representative Wagenius's question, you offered the individual to either pay what he bid, which he did bid, and unfortunately it seems like you've corrected the situation so it's less likely to happen in the future, or he'd have to rebid it again, and you made the mention that his biggest competitor is now eligible. So it's one that I really think, Mr. Chair, I really think that the claims committee should deal with this. There's some legitimate issues here that get, I'm not sure that we want to set a precedent to tie their hands. I don't know if the department did anything different than what you could have. And truthfully, I don't know if the logger did anything different. I mean, he's disappointed. He wanted the logs more than anything, but when he looks back, he was bidding against somebody that wasn't even eligible to bid. And there, we could surmise that of the other bidders, maybe one of them would have looked at it as a bargain. Would it have been somewhere between $0 and $40,000? I'm assuming it would have been somewhere. If the two that were geographically the ones that wanted it the most, and only one of them was eligible, that really doesn't leave two. That only leaves one now. And that person probably wouldn't need to pay what he'd have to pay if he, and I've been there. You can get a lot more competitive if you have a couple of people fighting over some work as opposed to only one, and the other competitors are geographically not right. Mr. Chair, I think this is one that we should think about. It seems like this gentleman, I'm assuming it's a gentleman, I shouldn't make that assumption, but it seems like a legitimate claim that it maybe should be dealt with that way, but it's your bill, Mr. Chair.
Anyone else on this issue? I want to ask one thing, Ms. Donaldson, since you're up here. One of the things that I asked for the department to do was to sell the track over the counter, to void the sale and to sell the track over the counter. And you told me, as I remember, well, then anyone could come and get it then. And I said that was fine with the logger, but you guys said, the department said that you wouldn't sell this track over the counter, that you would only sell it at the highest bid. That is I remember that distinctly, because one of the things I wanted done was to sell it over the counter, and Mr. Meyer suggested that you would sell it over the counter.
Mr. Chair, okay. Are you looking for, are you expecting a response for an answer? Is there a question in that?
Yes. Did you try and sell it over the counter?
I think we did try to sell it over the counter, Mr. Chair.
Can you explain what over the counter means?
Over the counter would be where it would be where we would just offer the wood to the logger, comes into the office, and we sell it to him over the counter. It's just a passing thing that's not done via auction. The ways that to sell the wood are either via the oral auction, the sealed bid auction, or over-the-counter type of a sale like that. Over-the-counter sales are usually reserved for small quantities of wood, say, that come up when we at the tag end of a sale where something hasn't occurred, maybe they're forced to miss a piece or something like that. The logger comes in and says, it really makes sense for us to finish up this piece out there. And that's the sort of thing then where we would offer it over-the-counter to that particular logger.
Mr. Epperly.
Mr. Chair, thank you. An over-the-counter sale, just for the committee's sake, is that it has to be advertised at least once, and for whatever reason it hasn't sold and somebody couldn't make a request. It is department policy, because of the nature of where the timber is and what land it's located on, and we do have that ability to move it towards the auction. Obviously, it brings a higher price, and that's the fiduciary side of that response.
I think that's a good.
Okay, Mr. Zometta, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Been lively and spirited. Welcome. And to Section 2 of the bill, if you could explain that to the membership.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Dave Zometta. I'm Executive Director of the Minnesota Forest Resources Council. The amendment to the bill involves appropriation of $50,000, one-time appropriation fiscal year 2009, to complete a study of parcelization of forest land in Minnesota. I think there's a handout that you should have related to that that's entitled Minnesota Forest Resource Council's Working Forest Land Conservation Initiative. I'll summarize that quite briefly. Just say there's 16 million acres of forest land in the state. Almost half of that is privately owned. Parcelization of those lands is a very significant concern. It's the Forest Resource Council's number one policy issue that we've been addressing for several years. There's effects on timber availability, wildlife habitat, water quality, recreational access, including hunting. And the council proposed this study, three parts to it, an assessment of the trends, drivers, and effects of forest parcelization and subsequent development, assessment of available policy responses, and then recommendations to the legislature. The governor's recommended budget in 2007 included $200,000 for this study, but ultimately the study was not funded. It got through late in the conference committee, it was not funded ultimately. As a result of that, the council went out and got a $100,000 commitment from the Blandon Foundation, $50,000 commitment from Iron Range Resources. What we are seeking is $50,000 to make the $200,000, and the other funds are contingent on us getting this $50,000. from the legislature. We won't get anything if we don't get the $50,000. So we've got $3 here, and we need $1 to make it whole. The governor's supplemental budget includes $3,000 in one-time funds to satisfy this matching requirement. Just learned that on Friday. And so I'm before you at your request testifying on this.
Any questions, Representative Genius? Well, Genius, do you have any questions on this? Okay. Anyone else? Anyone like to testify for or against this section of the bill? Okay, there being none, any further discussion on the bill? Okay, the chair renews his motion. House File 3898 as amended be recommended to pass and sent to Environment Policy. In favor of the motion, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Okay, next item up will be the DNR with some information regarding Leech Lake fisheries and related studies. Welcome, Ms. Carter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, Ron Player, Minnesota DNR Fish and Wildlife. Mr. Chairman, I believe each of the committee members should have a document titled Current Status of the Leech Lake Fishery and Related Study. And that was a report that was required by January 15th from last session. And I'll quickly go through the report. Maybe starting with the background, as many know, Leech Lake has historically been known as the walleye capital of the world. It's provided a tremendous walleye fishery. But in the early 2000s, we hadn't had a year class for about a decade. 1997 was a strong year class, and we had one that started in 2001. It looked very good, and it disappeared. About that time, we saw large increases in the numbers of double-crested cormorants. So we worked with local community and developed a five-year plan, and that plan called for a protected flat limit that was primarily oriented around protecting brood fish. We didn't have the young fish, and we wanted to be sure that we had brood fish so that we had reproductive capability. Working with the Leech Lake Band, we controlled double-crested cormorant numbers. We've done a research project on the effects of rusty crayfish, which is an invasive species to Leech Lake that is there in very high numbers. And then we stocked walleye fry. We marked those with what's called oxytetracycline so that we can determine in the fall what percentage of the fall fingerlings were wild versus stocked. Based on the last year's fish population assessment, things are on the right trend for Leech Lake. We've achieved most of the management goals that were delineated. And if down under the status of the fishery on page one, some of the key features are the biomass of mature female walleyes, which is very important, again, in terms of reproductive capability, was well above the goal of 1.25 to 1.75. It was up over 2. The gillnet catch rate for walleye was the second highest on record, and both the 2005 and 2006 year classes, which is the year either fry or hatched or stock, are very strong. The link frequency, and we'll look at some charts here in a minute, is very similar to walleye distributions on other large lakes, including the number of larger fish. Moving on to page two, just another point that I would make there in the second paragraph is the catch rate of yellow perch is well above the 1983 to 2007 average. And what we saw when the cormorants came in, Leech Lake is segregated into the large, shallower basin and the deeper waters on the western edge. And the western deeper waters maintained fairly well, but we saw declines in perch and in walleye in the open basins where cormorants were foraging. Figure one on page three just kind of outlines in graphic form the mature female biomass. We go back to 1988 and can see that the 2007 results are very favorable. Down in figure two, the gillnet catches, the clear circles are walleye, and going back to 1983, which is when we started the Large Lake program, those numbers are coming up, as are yellow perch. On page four, there's a comparison with some of our other major walleye waters, and on the bottom axis is total length in inches. So if you look, it'd be 2 inches, 6 inches, 14 inches, and then the frequency in our gillnet. And you can see that Leech Lake has a nice mixture of smaller and larger fish, which is comparable, generally comparable, to other good walleye lakes, such as Lake of the Woods, Cass Lake, Winnebagoche. And then on page five, there's just a graphic that shows yellow perch distribution, and see the number of fish. And we're starting to see a larger number of bigger perch in the lake, and Leech Lake's also known as a pretty outstanding yellow perch fishery. So the walleye population is looking good, the numbers are good, the distribution is good. On page five, the double-crested cormorant, working with Wildlife Services in the Leech Lake Band, we've removed over 9,000 birds from Leech Lake. We had a goal of 500 nesting pairs on Leech Lake, and that was based on kind of the number. In 1998, there were only 78 nesting pairs, and it just mushroomed up. By 2001, we had 2,500 nesting pairs. So based on some work in Lake Oneida, New York, and where we saw the numbers going up, we set a goal of 500 nesting pairs. And we're pretty close to that. We'll continue these control efforts to strive for the 500 nesting pairs this year. At that point in time, we've been conducting a cormorant diet analysis. That's articulated in the next paragraph. And while walleye generally comprise less than 1% of the diets, there haven't been a lot of walleye until the last couple years, and we need to run fish consumption modeling to figure out really what the overall impact would be and what level of control we might set. So I'll talk about that right at the end. On page six, we talk about rusty crayfish research that we've been working in conjunction with Bemidji State University. At this point in time, we're not seeing that crayfish predation on walleye eggs is similar to native crayfish. What we're not sure of is there's just huge numbers of rusty crayfish in Leech Lake, and we're not sure whether or not those numbers would reflect an increased predation. But those experiments will be repeated this spring and a final report available around the end of June. Stocking. We stocked 7.5 million marked walleye fry in 2005, 22 million in 2006, and 7.5 million again in 2007. And can see that in the fall, we stock these as fry, we mark them in the fall, we net. And in 2005, 39% were stocked fish. In 2006, 86% were stocked fish. And in 2007, 23% were stocked. Our plan, per our agreement with in discussions up there, would be to stock 20 million more marked fry this year in 2008. And then, barring a major change in the status of the fishery, we're not anticipating that we would stock in 2009. We'll assess at that point in time and determine whether or not the fishery is still on the trend that we want. We point out in the summary that while walleye stocking has contributed, it's definitely contributed to the increase in walleye abundance, we're not quite sure to what degree the stocked fish have replaced natural fish or how well natural reproduction might articulate itself in Leech Lake. So we're very interested in that. There's no reason, looking at the brood fish, fry survivability, egg hatchery, there's really no reason that Leech Lake should not be a natural self-sustaining walleye fishery. the one thing that we'll be looking at is a lot of the investigations, the experimental regulation evaluation, cormorant diet study, rusty crayfish research, will all be coming to fruition this summer. And we had a meeting with many of the local community members on December 17th, and we're going to work with them to develop a longer-term plan, management plan for Leech Lake. And we'll be looking at some goals and assessment to mark where we're at. So that's pretty much a summary of what's going on in Leech Lake. We're pretty pleased with the status of the lake right now. Some of the dynamics have been difficult up there, but we've managed to work with the local community and have been influenced by the local community in what we've done. So with that, I stand for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Pryor. Representative Moe, did you have a question?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I would agree with you that lake has turned around remarkably, and it's a terrific success story for us. And as you know, based on all of your work up there, the future management of that lake is of great concern to the surrounding residents. And there still is somewhat of a dispute over how to proceed. You know, I think you could agree with that assessment. Two points that you could respond to. One is the stocking that has been done has surprised a lot of us as to the effectiveness of it. It wasn't anticipated that the natural reproduction was that bad, and then we've seen how the amount of stockfish that come back in your gill nets is above what we expected, right? I mean, I think that was somewhat of a surprise to you. Maybe I'll just let you respond to that one.
Sure, Madam Chair, Representative Moore, that is correct. I think when we stocked the 7.5 million fry in 2005, and our original plans were only to stock 5 million, when we had 39% of the fall fingerlings marked, that definitely surprised us. And the next year, when we stocked 22 million fry, it was 86%. And what we're trying to tease out is, and Dr. Don Ferrer made that presentation in December, is when you stock on top of the wild fry, eventually you're going to have a funnel, and there will be so many fish due to carrying capacity that will come through. We're not sure how much that stocking is replacing natural reproduction. So you'd expect on a year when you stock 22 million that you'd see a higher percentage. But there's no question that surprised us. And we need a number of year classes in Leech Lake. We've got 2005, 2006 that are definitely strong year classes. 2007 is looking like it could be pretty good, but obviously we want to keep that thread going. But we think by stocking the 20 million, which is the higher rate this year, and then not stocking next year, we'll have some pretty good year classes in there, and we'll be able to have a lot better determination on how well natural reproduction is functioning in the lake. And hopefully it will be self-sustaining. I think everybody would like that at some point in time.
Representative Moe.
Thank you, Ms. Barr. The next question is, as you know, there's a large group in the area of Leech Lake Fisheries Task Force, and Fishing Task Force, would like to see the lake stocked at a higher level annually, and there's legislation here in the House and the Senate to accomplish that and fund that. But from your perspective, we should wait that year, and the justification for waiting that year is to allow for information gathering to see how effective it is. But from the perspective of those people who want to stock, they need some insurance policy because they lived through the lake going down. And you would argue that having that information, teasing out the effectiveness of the stocking previously, is more important than having that insurance policy to, well, you know, so much of the science, we got a business there to operate, we can't be patient, or we can't. So you think it's more important, though, obviously, to
Mr. Pyor?
Madam Chair, Representative Moll, we certainly recognize the importance of Leech Lake to the Walker area particularly, and there's other large lakes that drive local economies, and so I don't think there's any question that our goals are the same. It's just how do you get there and what assurance. And we do believe with looking at this population and the length structure and the age structure, and the fact that we're stocking 20 million this year, that it would be probably the best long-term solution to find out. If we find out there is no natural reproduction, then we're certainly going to have to reboot, and we're not saying we would never stock again. We're just saying we think it'd be very valuable to find out whether or not natural reproduction will express itself starting in 2009, and we see no reason, and we've been surprised. There's been certainly some surprises there, but we see no reason it wouldn't. And the fact that we're going to work with not only the local community but some statewide interest to develop a long-range plan over the course of this summer and the fall gives us time to kind of sort that out and figure out what kind of benchmarks might be reasonable as we move ahead. And excuse me, Madam Chair, but then where would we consider stock? I think that would be the type of thing that we would look at in that type of plan.
Representative Moll.
I appreciate you letting me press you here on this a little bit. As you know, again, legislation is coming forward, and what if, say, in the following year where you're not stocking, research comes back and says, well, it seems pretty clear that stocking is more effective, natural reproduction is not quite there yet. What would the department's response be then?
Mr. Pyor.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Moll, if we came up next year and found no natural reproduction, then we'd have to sit down and take a serious look at what we might do either that year or the following year in terms of stocking. And we have no disagreement that we want the same thing. And if stocking is necessary to sustain Leech Lake or get it up and running, we're not opposed to doing that. We're just thinking that at this point in time, generally on your large lakes, you don't see two strong year classes in a row. That's just a competitive thing. And we would just think it would be better. We would be surprised if natural reproduction didn't start expressing itself. But if it bombed, then we need to sit down, and that's the type of thing we'll talk to the local community about. How do we handle that?
Thank you.
Representative Virginia. Thank you. I had an opportunity to go to Peter Sorensen's lab at the University of Minnesota and see his work on carp and just see what they're doing there. Have we had that same kind of intensive study on walleye that they're doing on carp?
Madam Chair, Representative Wilkini, it's not so much in terms of the pheromones and things. We have a tremendous database on walleye, but not in the particular arena that Dr. Sorensen is working in.
Representative Virginia. Well, he's looking at pheromones, but he's also looking at years in which carp are there, or ages of carp. And I think one of the surprising findings was we expect the carp to 1-year-old, 3-year-old, 3-year-old, 4-year-old, but that's not what he found. It's like some 7-year-olds, and some 14-year-olds, and some 18-year-olds, and 19-year-olds, and 36-year-olds. And I think that kind of research, I mean, it just strikes me as that maybe we should be doing that same kind of open-ended research on walleye, since they're so important to this state, that are being done on carp. They're important in an exact opposite direction, but I just wondered if anybody proposed that kind of study. Mr. Pyor.
Madam Chair, Representative Lugenius, we do have a tremendous wealth of knowledge on walleye and how they spawn in your classes. We actually target those in our surveys and assessment, and we do about 600 of those a year. And so carp, because of the type of systems they're in, would be a little different. We measure them in our sampling, but we don't target them. So in terms of your classes and frequency, I think we do have a very good information base on walleye, and what Dr. Sorensen doing on carp is a surprise, and a lot of that is in the wetlands and in the more shallow waters where he's looking, and actually have him coming in about 3 weeks to talk to us a little bit more about that, so we can ask him whether he thinks there's anything that might be applicable.
Yeah. Representative Dean, I'm not thinking particularly about any one thing you want to know about walleye, like your sister. But what he was looking at was essentially for the carp's Achilles heel. And so he was kind of had wide open to look for that. And we may need to start thinking about, well, what are some of the Achilles heels for walleye? But just for the opposite reason. If we want the walleye, what's the problem? For carp, we're looking for their Achilles heel because we don't want it. But I have sensed that maybe for something that's so important to Minnesota, we ought to be doing some just basic science and doing some research. And the LCCMR just strikes me as, maybe we ought to think about that.
Representative Moe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative, if you're interested in us doing funding some additional research on walleye and the challenges we have in your committee, I'd be glad to carry that bill. We can put that in the bill. I'm sure that there's the DNR would, and some other, and Bemidji State University is doing much research similar to what you're talking about, specifically focusing on challenges to walleye. We could probably.
Okay. Representative Lugenius. Well, actually, I was thinking of LCCMR as the appropriate. They have put out different bids, and I have been surprised that the state agencies have not responded, at least in the last round of bidding, with proposals. Now, I don't know that. Well, except we funded Peter Sorensen at a good crack, just because of his work on finding some interesting things out about carp, and we said, okay, here's more money. I mean, essentially, that's what was going on. And so I think there's some opportunities that maybe we need to take advantage of. That's all. But I would suggest that route rather than the committee route. And then maybe could apply. Representative Hackbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Prior, I honestly don't know, and maybe you could enlighten us. Are there any kind of steering or netting or tribal harvest that takes place on these lakes?
Mr. Pryor.
Madam Chair, Representative Hackbarth, yes, there is. There's some subsistence netting and steering that goes on leech lake.
We always go to that, don't we?
And Madam Chair.
Representative Hackbarth.
Prior, that would be similar to what is that considered subsistence taking on Mille Lacs?
Mr. Pryor.
Madam Chair, Representative Hackbarth, the concept would be the same. On Mille Lacs, they can commercialize if they choose to. On Leech Lake, there's an agreement where we pay them a sum not to exercise those rights.
Representative Hackbarth.
I'm just curious then why that wasn't included in the status report.
Mr. Pryor.
Madam Chair, Representative Hackbarth, our understanding and reporting isn't real tight that we get from the Leech Lake Band, but our managers generally feel that the harvest taken by the Leech Lake Band is fairly minimal, and we could certainly include that in future updates and assess that, but we don't have very tight reporting. We get some estimates based on talking to the band natural resources people, but at least over the last number of years, the estimates have been somewhere in the 5,000 to 10,000 pound range of walleye. I don't know with the decline in the walleye population if that would still be an accurate number, but a few years ago that was the number that was relayed to me. Thank you.
Any further questions? Representative Moe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick comment to that effect, and Mr. Pryor knows that the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe has been very active in the resurgence and management of the lake, and in fact, it's through Leech Lake that the Cormorant control is actually done So their contracted employees are out there shooting cormorants. So the work that they're doing is very integral to getting this lake back.
Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Pryor, on page 6, the rusty crayfish research, maybe in the future report you could state where how much money was spent on some of these publicly funded research projects and where the source came from. And the same on the double-crested cormorant control, if we've removed 9,000 birds, you know, what the public cost was for removing 9,000 birds and where that money came from.
Mr. Pryor.
Madam Chair, Ms. Hanson, I know on the cormorants, between the Division of Fish and Wildlife and the Division of Ecological Resources, we're contributing about $32,000 a year. Wildlife Services actually does the control work. So there's staff time in addition. We'll be glad to find those numbers. On the rusty crayfish, there's been some grants that the Leech Lake Band has received, and then we've contributed as well. So we'll get those here very soon. It's easy to come.
Any further questions? Thank you, Mr. Pryor. We now have the DNR's deer hunting regulation simplification effort. Is Dick Sternberg in the audience? Wants to testify on the Leech Lake report? If you could state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Dick Sternberg, and I'm here to represent the Leech Lake Fishing Task Force that Representative Moe referred to. I'm a fish biologist by trade, and I've been working with the Leech Lake Task Force for about 3 years now. And during that time, as you've all heard, we have seen this dramatic comeback in the Leech Lake walleye population. But the problem that I see is that we have not seen a recovery in the natural walleye reproduction. So we are still very concerned about the whole question of, are we going to have fish for the future? And I was happy to hear Mr. Pryor say today that we're not abandoning the stocking program, because that was not what was represented in our latest edition of our outdoor news, when the local fisheries managers pretty much gave us the impression that there would be no more stocking, and they said it was time for the lake to start reproducing on its own. And of course, we've all been concerned with this issue about the rusty crayfish. We've been talking about that here today. And, of course, the issue of the rusty crayfish is that the mysterious problem that we suspect it could be limiting this walleye natural reproduction, because they are very large, aggressive crayfish. There's lots of them, and they do eat eggs. And so I was disappointed by the results of the research findings that, you know, I'm not disappointed, I'm kind of surprised, I should say, at the results of the research findings, which was also reported in Outdoor News, that the rusty crayfish now have been deemed to be not a problem. And which is very surprising in light of the fact that the rusty crayfish research this year was pretty much a disaster because of problems with weather that pretty much prevented them from examining their nets and finding out what was really going on, so they're going to reschedule it for next year. But like I say, despite that fact, we're publishing things that this is not a problem, and I don't really believe that myself. At least I'm not convinced by the research that that's the fact. Now, I guess when Mr. Pryor testified, I didn't really hear for sure that we're going to continue stocking if necessary. He said that we'd evaluate it and make a determination. I think I would like to hear a little clearer statement on that to sort of rest our concerns. Now, this disagreement over we have had some disagreements over the stocking. And as Mr. Pryor testified, the DNR plan was to stock 5 million fry in 2005, 2006, and 2007. And through the efforts of the local community, we did convince them to bump the stocking rates up considerably. Instead of the 15 million total, I think there's now been 37 million total that have gone into the lake, and there'll be another 20 this year, so that'll be 57 million. So that effort, that increase has been a result of local community pressure, and it's turned out to be the right pressure because the stocking has been wildly successful, and we would like to make sure that it's not going to end prematurely. And I think a real startling statistic is that 73% of the walleyes produced in the last 2 years have been produced through stocking. Now, you can argue that maybe that some of that was the replacement, as they call it, which is kind of a new term to me as a biologist. I've never heard anybody talk about replacement before. So I'm just wondering if there isn't a lot of speculation going on here that maybe that could be happening. And as Representative Moe suggested, maybe we should, you know, instead of speculating about whether this may be happening, maybe we should just continue to stock and make sure that we have an insurance policy, because we're not going to reduce the number of walleyes that are in the lake by stocking. We may not wind up with any more, but at least we're going to know the ones we stock are there. I think that's what everybody's looking at right now at this point. There's been, you know, a lot of other things here that I think have been sort of, we differ with the DNR. We've had our differences, there's no doubt about it. There's been a lot of local contentious meetings. There's been a lot of things that have happened. And I think, all in all, I think that what we have suggested from the Leech Lake Fishing Task Force has all been very positive. It's all turned out to be pretty true. I mean, there's an argument over whether cormorants were the problem way back before we started any of this. And, of course, the task force and the local community swore up and down that the cormorants were the problem, and the DNR said they didn't think the cormorants were the problem. And we brought up some of this research that was done in Lake Oneida and found out that they controlled the cormorants in Lake Oneida, and the walleyes came back. And we started doing that here, and the walleyes came back. And the rusty crayfish thing is really, really a huge question. I think that we really should not dismiss the possibility that that's a problem. I remember Mr. Pryor back a couple years ago when we started seeing these huge amounts of survival of these walleye fry. His comment was that there's something going on here that we don't really understand. And I think that's still the case today. There is something going on here that we don't understand, because we are not seeing the type of reproduction that there really ought to be. Now, this year, we had, I'm surprised to hear Mr. Pryor say there was another pretty good year class coming this year. I think that was the term he used, because the walleye count this year, as measured by the DNR trawling, which is the way that they do measure it, was 32 walleyes per hour. The historic average is 130 per hour. And in 2005 and 2006, it was somewhere around 240 per hour. But of course, a lot of that was stocked. So we can't really, it's not an apples-to-apples comparison. But last year, even with a relatively low stocking, we got 32 walleyes per hour. That's not good. So that was, in effect, sort of a blank year like they're talking about. So do we need to have another blank year now to prove that walleye reproduction is not really occurring? So, and there, we know there's a bill in the House here right now. I think it's Representative Howe's bill, which would provide for stocking through 2010, and we hope the committee will support it. But our concerns really extend beyond 2010. I mean, there really should be no end date on whether or not we're going to stock this lake. If the lake needs to be stocked, then it should be stocked. And I have no problem with the blank year now and then, but when the blank year doesn't show anything, we better continue stocking. And I think we need a commitment by that for the DNR. Thank you very much. Any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Sternberg. Are there any questions? Representative Moe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Sternberg, you know, I know there's many of citizens up in the walk area have worked a long time on this. If the DNR wants an open year to assess the effects of stocking, you know, you said maybe that would be a good idea. What would your expectations be on the following year then? And I mean, you're speaking, you can't speak to the whole fishing task force, but Okay, so we have a year, and we kind of assess, you know, how the lake's doing. Come back the following year. What would a reasonable approach in your mind be then?
Mr. Sternberg.
Representative Moe, I would suggest that if there is a blank year and there is no significant reproduction, now that would have to be defined. Now, I think it was very significant this year myself. But, yeah, absolutely, the lake should be stocked the following year.
And at what level do you think would be appropriate?
Well, we had, Representative Moe, we had a discussion about this several years ago. And since we are in an aggressive recovery mode, we had agreed to a level of 175 fingerlings per hour of trawling would be the trigger. And we did, in fact, make that number in 2006, I guess it was, 2005 and 2006, actually. And so there really was no stocking planned in 2007. That would have been a stocking of, a large stocking, I should say, of 23 million is what we had agreed to, or 22 million. And the DNR did agree to stock 7.5 million in 2007, but that was more for evaluation purposes, because if you don't have some stocked fish in the lake, you can't tell which are stocked and which are natural. So so that really was not a full-scale stocking in 2007. And so in 2008, I would hope that we could get at least another 23 million, because that was the number that was agreed to originally. I think they're talking 20 million right now. But, you know, you really have to evaluate what's going on to see if that's the right number. That number was just pulled out of the hat, the 23 million. And that was the reason for that number was that that was all that was available of the strain that the DNR deemed acceptable. Couldn't get any more. Now, the task force, of course, has argued for much higher stockings, and of course we don't know whether higher stockings would have worked or not, because we never tried it. And so the only way we're going to find out is to try a higher stocking. So what that number is, we'd have to discuss.
Thank you, Mr. Sternberg. I think we're going to move on to the DNR's deer hunting regulations.
Thank you very much.
Simplification effort. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Ed Bogus, DNR Division of Fish and Wildlife, and in the interest of time, I'm going to just make a few very brief remarks and turn it over to Lou Cornicelli, our big game program consultant. Wanted to just take a few minutes to brief the committee on a deregulation simplification project that we started late last year with a cross-section of deer hunters and landowners to look comprehensively at a deer management system that's been in place for about 30 years and come up with some recommendations for simplifying the approach while maintaining our ability to manage the deer population. So looks like Mr. Cornicelli is ready to go. I'll just turn it over to him to do a brief presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Bogus. If you could state your name for the record.
Madam Chair, for the record, Lou Cornicelli, Big Game Program Coordinator, Minnesota DNR. I'll be brief. Being from the East Coast, I can talk as fast as you want, so I'll do this pretty quickly. We've put together a committee. Commissioner Holson had asked last year for us to figure out a way to simplify the deer regulations. So what we did was we put together a group of 13 stakeholders, basically representing all over the state, as many interests as we could find, yet in a group size that was manageable. So they came from a variety of interests, everything from knowing the northwest part of the state to being a new hunter. And we asked them to take a top-down look at the regulations, not in a way that we didn't say, why don't you look at this, why don't you look at that. These recommendations are their own, but they're highly supported by our data. So what they did was they met twice around the holidays and came up with the recommendations I'll talk about. There's four. Three of them are statutory. One of them is in rules. First one is consolidate the number of deer hunting licenses, and I'll go through that, and you've kind of got a handout as well. also consolidate the number of zones that we have. We currently have 6, and that's the rule piece of this. Simplify validation of the deer license at the site of the harvest, and also simplify our legal calibers that we allow in the state for deer hunting. Why consolidate licenses? We really want a hunter only to buy a license that they for the season they want to hunt. The off-season license that we're proposing to get rid of comes with 3 tags. It's difficult to explain because the person may not be able to use all 3 tags in the area they hunt. In fact, 2/3 of the state they can't. We also have a case where hunters aren't hunting all 3 seasons. They're only hunting 2 of the 3 seasons. So it's a license that we sell a bunch of opportunities for people who really don't have an interest in all that opportunity. There's a real interest in, and as you see, the scope on muzzleloader thing that comes up every year, in muzzleloader hunting, but in this state you can't buy a firearms license and a muzzleloader license. You have to buy an all season. So we're going to look at changing that. And in just general acceptance, with all of our licenses, we have a lot of acceptance what you can and can't do. So the proposal is really to streamline some of this. What we'd like to do is to look at this thing we have to explain every year in the regulations book. We have 3 adult deer hunting licenses just for the firearm season that anyone can buy. We want to eliminate the all-season and the multi-zone buck and just let you buy 3 standalone licenses. Basically, we have a system of licenses that come with 3 tags. You can't use all 3 tags. Another license you can use in some parts of the state but not others. And then regular licenses that are just zone-specific. So it gets kind of difficult to explain. We want to take this and basically turn it into that, where you just buy your parent licenses, whether it's archery, firearm, muzzleloader. We've got bag limits based on where we're going with deer populations, and let the hunter figure out how many deer they can kill based on the individual licenses they've purchased. Zone consolidation, like I talked about, we want to go from 6 to 2. The 2 zones, the structure around our traditional A openers, are familiar with that, and then the 3B season in the southeastern part of the state. So we just have a standard opening date like we have every year, and then we keep kind of a soft zone boundary in our what would be our traditional zones, and the season would be 16 days, 9 days, depending on where you are, well, in a line that wouldn't change annually. And we also would like to eliminate our zone 4 and just put it into a zone 2 type 9-day season. So basically, in a nutshell, we sell licenses for 4 zones here and then 2 extras that overlap as a 4A, 4B, and a 3A, 3B. And if you buy, say, a Zone 1 license, you're limited to that solid line. You kind of go up against the arrow and stop. And if you're in Zone 2, it's the same thing. Zone 4A, 4B, same thing. So what we're looking to do is basically remove those hard lines and just have an A-season license, and you could go anywhere in the state during that A-season. The permit areas in that 100 block would be 16 days like they are now, 200 would be 9 days like they are now, and so on and so forth. So basically go from 4 A licenses down to 1, and then 2 B licenses down to 1. Third recommendation from the committee was to get rid of this red circled area. This is a new piece of statute from 06 where hunters had to mark their license when they killed a deer in addition to site tagging. We have another site tag that goes below that. We're retaining that to get rid of this one notch. Most people don't even know about it. It just hasn't seemed like it was a needed piece of regulation. So in order to simplify tagging, we just get rid of that notch. And then finally, we have probably the most complex legal cartridge description in the Midwest, and certainly in Midwest, maybe nationally, in terms of what you can and can't use. We have that description, then we have a whole bunch of exceptions that get passed every few years. Most recently, the 30 carbine, 50-50 Spencer, and a couple of the Spencer cartridges, which are old, obsolete, buffalo rounds. But every couple of years, there's another exception coming down the road. So we looked at our surrounding states, and most of the 2 states have no minimum distance center fire. And we're not talking about 22 long rifles, the little things. It's center fire rifle cartridges. 2 states have no minimum. 3 states basically have a 22 center fire, and Iowa has a 24 center fire. So we think we can simplify it just by doing what 5 out of the 6 states do, and that's 22 center fire or greater, and be done with it. Hunters have the ability to know what firearm is applicable to deer, and we don't have a real concern with hunters using something that's substandard, or at least any more substandard than what's legal now. So it really just simplifies it. And that's all I had. just for this portion. I could certainly take questions. I apologize for going quickly, but I realized I probably wanted to go home.
I appreciate that. Are there any questions for the testifier? Representative Hansen?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question that's not on deer, but since you're here, moose. And we've had articles in the paper in the last few weeks about the decline in the moose population, and just, I know people want to go, but just a few minutes on what the DNR is planning to do relating to the moose population decline.
Madam Chair, yeah, we're doing quite a bit of moose work with the tribes, looking at research and moose mortality. Right now, we're putting radio collars on animals. We're also looking at our hunter harvested moose for blood work, for screening for known pathogens, diseases, and trying to get a handle on why we're observing mortality that's in excess of what we see nationally in other moose. But right now, there's no smoking gun, and there's no one indicator as to why moose are in decline. But we do have radio collars on a lot of animals, looking at mortality, well, survival mortality, production in females, and then also the blood work through harvest moose to see if we could figure out exactly what it is. And of course, we're partnering with other agencies and the bands on habitat projects, whether it's moose thermal cover in the summer or you know, water openings and brushland removal or brushland management, trying to make moose habitat and how that all relates with deer populations, we don't know. But certainly we're looking at it from as many angles as we can look at it, but there's nothing definitive right now.
Representative Hansen.
Do you need more money?
Mr. Farnsell.
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, I'll defer to Deputy Director Ed Boggess on that one.
Mr. Boggess.
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, currently we have, through partnerships with the tribes and some federal grants that they have, we have what we think is a good moose research program moving forward. We just completed the survey of moose that we do every winter, and even though the counts were a little higher than they had been the year before, all the other indications that Mr. Coruscelli talked about are still consistent with a declining population. So I guess longer term, I would say short term, we think we're adequately looking at what's happening with moose, but longer term, depending on what we may find, I guess that question's still somewhat open.
Any further questions? Thank you for the report. Before we finish up tonight, I wanted to thank Andrea Page, who's kept us going through some long committees, and appreciate the work. Because this is our last meeting, I wanted to recognize you and thank you for helping out the committee. If there's no further business, the committee is adjourned.